Disclaimer. The views and opinions you hear expressed by the participants in the show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. Enjoy the show! Hey everybody, welcome to Ancast. I'm Zach Birchie. A very special guest this week. Glad to have her on. It's Leah Hernandez. She is the author of a webcomic called Bunny Garu over at boingboing.net. That's about her year working for Gainax back in the day, along with the sadly departed Torrin Smith. You can also find her work on the Teen Titans Go digital comic for DC Digital. Leah, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, Zach.
So, I first heard about your history with Gainax, obviously, through your comic. I had heard your name bandied about, in the past. I've been doing this 15 years. You've been doing it even longer. And I kind of want to just start at the beginning. So leading up to you working for Gainax in the late 80s, early 90s,
yeah.
Tell us, what were the 80s like for you? I assume you were an anime and manga fan back then.
Oh, yeah. And that was, working in the business was, all I wanted to do. You know, it was my dream job. But, it was so hard to get stuff, which you probably heard over and over again as you interview people who were in fandom for, 25, 30 or more years.
Yeah.
Manga, localized manga was just starting to come out to actually get it, you either had to have a friend in California, or in our case in Dallas, you had to find a Japanese market that was importing things. It was incredibly costly, but it was like a treasure hunt. A videotape was outrageously costly. If an imported one, a one-hour movie could cost $100 by the time the import was paid for. A lot of tapes were traded amongst fans. They generally seemed to originate in California because the fandom was strong in this one, in the Los Angeles and Inland Empire area. So they would start here and then disseminate out to Colorado and then to, Texas and to San Antonio and Dallas.
Mm-hmm.
And it was great because everything was new and fresh, and generally it seemed, you've probably heard this from others, it seemed so smart because we really didn't know what they were saying. So you're like, oh, this is so deep, I just know it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then you get that, as Adam Warren has said, then you finally get that translation of Dirty Pair, and you realize that they're just telling each other how fat each other's asses are. And you're like, is that it? Really? Is that all there is? But it was still, and there was still fresh new stuff coming out, and people who were going to be tremendously huge later were doing their first works, like Mikimoto on Macross, and Gainax making Wings of Aniamis, and you could find like a million generations down copy of Daikon 3 and 4. And one time we even had a TV commercial of the Daikon mascot girl. Who else? Anno worked on Wings of Aniamis, and Gunbuster was coming out in the late 80s. It's about, it came out just before I started working for Gainax. And so, like I was saying, all these people who were getting big and who were going to be big were all doing their early work then. And it was, it was cool. It was different. And I have loved anime pretty much my whole life. I first started seeing Speed Racer when I was 6. And when I was 6, I was like, this is it. This is exactly what I've been waiting for the whole 6 or 7 years of my life. It's like Disney's kind of okay, but I don't want to watch it unless it's cartoons. Saturday morning cartoons are okay, but I figured out, you know, Scooby-Doo's formula after two episodes. And Speed Racer was, you know, interesting and episodic, and there was drama, and there was, you know, intrigue, and there was that subplot about whether or not they would ever figure out who Racer X was. I loved it, even though it was a terribly expensive hobby and subject to a lot of really, a lot of wonderful cooperation and friendship, but also a lot of really super ugly, unpleasant infighting at the time. Mm-hmm. But in general, I'm not unaware of the problems of that time, not just that it was costly and not just that there was ugly fan infighting, but also aware of how new and fresh it was to me. And every time something new came out, it was just like you were getting that rush all over again, that here was this cool new thing. So there's your answer. It was great. It was horrible and it was great, but mainly it was great.
Well, it's funny that you bring up horrible fan infighting because, you know, I'm about a decade removed from your time.
Yes.
Starting out as an anime fan, I came into it in the mid to late 90s, and the ugly fan
Another
infighting.
Another great time to start.
I'm sorry, what?
Another great time to start in fandom.
I think so. That was a lot of good
time.
Stuff then.
mm-hmm. Yes.
But so, what were your experiences like with the fans back then? Do you have any stories from those days of, like, you know, dealing with obstinate fans, like, at, you know, at the club or whatever?
Well, mainly the problem was the clubs had the problem. You could sort of have you ever heard of the fanboy fallacies?
Yeah, of course. Yeah,
so you know, it's like an essay, and it's the fanboy fallacies. And the clubs that I was, you know, not only ran but, you know, attended, you know, had the fanboy fallacies. And, you know, really one of the most insidious ones for any group of people. Not just fan clubs, but that's mainly where my experience lies, but, you know, fan clubs and conventions. And that one fallacy of, we've got to include people.
Right.
It'll just fucking kill a fan club.
Yep.
It'll suck the fun out of a room because you always seem to have that one person, that one usually, unfortunately, a guy that, you know, nobody likes. You know, he's not weird or smelly. He's unpleasant.
Yeah.
Or he's kind of cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs. And he makes other people not want to come. He makes other people quit.
Yeah.
He makes other people, or she makes other people, generally, again, a guy. You know, he's upsetting. He's not only driving people away, he's stopping people from coming in, and yet nobody will get rid of that person.
Yeah.
And that happened. That happened a lot in these fan clubs. Between my ex and I ran a fan club in Dallas, and there was another anime fan club in Fort Worth, and there was a member of that fan club who just kind of flipped out because the president of the fan club, who was a talented and attractive woman named Karen Helmer, he developed a crush on Karen, and when she didn't reciprocate, you know, he called her answering machine and left death threats.
Oh, man. Something's never changed, you know?
I am like, I am not kidding. He freaking left death threats. And they actually had to have a vote on whether or not he should be allowed to continue to come to meetings.
Oh, God.
you would think that would not have to have a vote, but it had to have a vote. And then it was sort of like, the Fort Worth club kind of said to the Dallas club, he doesn't have a place to go anymore. You take him.
Like he's your child or something. Like,
yeah, like he's like, you're rehoming a puppy. So we take on this guy, and then another guy comes along and he's one of those, but you got to include him. Mm. And then he starts bringing a friend of his who, you know, is a grown-ass man with three kids under the age of five and a wife who clearly hates all this shit.
Yeah.
and they, it was just such, it was like, I hadn't thought about it in years till I started writing Body Garu, and then I'm thinking about it and, you know, and putting it through the filter of what can be done today. You know, I'm savaging people on Facebook and in email and on Twitter,
right.
And on message boards. I'm like, God, things don't change at all. The only advantage we have today over then is then we have a recording of a guy saying, the next time I see you, I'll kill you. And now we have screen caps.
Yeah, right.
But then there's just all this idiocy. Okay, you got to take this guy who, you know, leveled death threats at somebody. He's yours now. You have to take him. And this guy was just, I mean, he got therapy on my advice, and he really did seem to want to do better. But he was just he had problems. And then, like I said, we have this other guy who says, well, you gotta include him. Well, the reason why he wanted this guy to be included is because this guy was an engineer, so he made a shit ton of money, which meant he had the money to buy incredibly expensive stuff.
Oh, okay.
Which meant that the person who felt like we should include him got to be his friend and get first generation dubs of things.
Yeah, so
that's his whole agenda, is you got to let this guy keep coming so I can get first generation dubs of the, you know, $100, $200, $300 videotapes and laser discs and shit. And it was just like, and eventually what happened is I just was like, we had been meeting at our home early on in the whole fan club thing. And after, you know, a few people came to my home and then were just like bitching about how I didn't have the right sodas, I was like, okay, we're not having meetings at home anymore. This sucks. People are really disrespectful. We'll go to a pizza place. And the pizza place was cool. And then this death threat guy, when we're there, people wouldn't actually spend money like they were asked to. They would just come in and like sit and watch anime and not spend any money. The pizza place didn't like that. But death threat guy, during a birthday party, runs into the person carrying the cake for this birthday party, runs into them, destroys a whole birthday party's worth of cake, just knocks it right to the floor. And it was an accident, but he didn't quit moving and he didn't apologize. And at that point, the pizza place said, you're not making us any money anyway, even though nobody ever uses this room you're using, so hasta la bye-bye. And I was just... And there were other characters in it who started to show up to the meetings, and I would just say, that's at the point, after we inherited Death Threat Guy, that was the point where I said, you know what? If somebody is making other people uncomfortable, and they're unpleasant, and they're talking shit behind my back, then I'm going to tell them to go home and not come back, because I don't need this crap.
Yeah, but you're so right, though, and that's those geek social fallacies. Like, you could change the names of those people, and, you know, that mirrors my experience, too. Like, you're right that those geek social fallacies are just deadly, and they turn the anime club into a really unpleasant experience sometimes. Not to say there's no fond memories of those days, but...
They really do. I just, in general, I enjoyed some of the meetings, and some of the times when we got together were really fun, but in general, I just found running a fan club so stressful and so unpleasant, and I was one of the few women in it, and it really was weird. It wasn't like I got hassled for, you know, the friend of Death Threat Guy, his grown-ass man friend, you know, comes to our meetings and then tells me how much he likes my feet, and admits he has a foot fetish, and I'm just like, wow, I'm uncomfortable.
Oh,
and
God.
This guy's wife would call and say, he's been gone for 12 hours. Do you know where he is? And I'm like, he is a grown-ass man with 3 children under 5. I have no idea where he is. I think you have a problem that needs to be addressed with a counseling or an attorney.
Yeah.
And, but when the friend of grown-ass man decided he didn't like how I was doing things, he wrote letters to my ex complaining about how he didn't like that I didn't show up for a meeting one time because I had to work. And my ex, who's, you know, kind of a dodo. My ex kind of doesn't disagree with him. But when this guy insists that he must come to our place and we must buy him pizza and he must talk about this very deep and important issue, my ex just goes, okay. So I'm like right there in my own home with this dude talking shit to my ex right in front of me and eating pizza that we have paid for. And I'm like, this is bullshit. It's like, it's like nobody in the room except me could perceive how deeply fucked this was.
Yeah, really.
How incredibly deeply wrong and fucked this was. And when we moved to California in 1989, when we were finally done with all the fan club stuff, once we lost our meeting place in the pizza place, I said, well, that's the end of the fan club because I am not having a meeting in my own home.
Right.
Ever again. It's like, I've learned my lesson. It's like, we're just dealing with, some people are really great, and the people we really like, well, we'll just invite them over sometime, but I'm not opening my home to this cast of characters anymore, because it's, I get nothing out of it except a lot of, like, ground up guts, because right. They act like assholes, and my ex just sits there and goes, oh. So, But when we moved to California in 89, I actually made a really conscious decision, for better or for worse. I don't really know what the fan clubs in the Bay Area were like. I want all the people that were in fan clubs in 1989 and on to understand that I'm not dissing you, because I have no idea what you were like. But after the experiences I had in Texas, I made a conscious decision to not go to any anime fan clubs, because I was just so burnt out
right. On
the whole experience. And later on, I met some people from those clubs, and some of them were great, and some of them were total secret master of fandom asshats. And I felt like it kind of validated my decision to stay out of that.
Yeah. Well, you, I mean, you
I got nothing out of it. Go you, ahead. Yeah. I'm sorry.
I was just saying, you outgrow it. You outgrow those people, and you learn eventually, as I think a lot of fans do as they get older, like, okay, just because these people like the same dumb things that I like,
yeah. Doesn't
mean we're going to get along. It doesn't mean I'm going to enjoy spending time around them, and it doesn't mean that they have any social grace, like, whatsoever. So, like, I think it's something you just learn as you get older. But that's interesting.
You get older, and your tolerance for that crap kind of fades, and in my case, My tolerance for people tolerating that crap was just like, wow, somebody just nuked that tolerance from orbit. I have none left. I can't even. I have lost the capacity to even.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, yeah. Go on.
So 89. This must have been you moved to California. It's 1989, and you're just about to get work with Gainax. So what were the seeds of that? How did that get started? And walk us through this period in your life.
Okay, well, I had started to kind of learn to letter for Torrin Smith. I was working as an assistant to a letterer named Wayne Truman on a book called Xenon, spelled with an X, X-C-N-O-N. Mm-hmm. And I was his assistant for a while. And because, you know, that was my first foot in the door. Also during that time, I worked at an animation studio as a freelancer, you know, and I got all this by just making a ton of cold calls. And I'm trying to make inroads into the comics business, you know, taking that sweet, sweet $250 for 24 pages rate.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and doing fan art and just, you know, putting my stuff in art shows and asking for critiques and making cold calls and going everywhere all over Dallas. There were art studios. And like I said, I was starting, you know, I struck up a friendship with Torrin Smith and with Adam Warren, and Tom Orzechowski was working for me. Tom was working with me to train him. And in case people don't know, Tom is the completely legendary letterer of X-Men, and he worked on the Spawn comic in its very early days. He lettered all of the, I believe Tom lettered the Nausicaa manga when it was at Viz, and he also lettered... Tom also lettered anything from Studio Proteus that was Shirō Masamune's. Tom was the letter on it because, you know, Tom had a superhuman tolerance for like 30 balloons a page in tiny type. So I went there to kind of apprentice with Tom. You know, it took a month there, but I was really, really discouraged about my comics career, which was awfully young at that point. I think I'd only been at it for 5 years, but it was just terribly discouraging. There was a lot of inappropriate behavior at conventions, a lot of sexually inappropriate behavior. I was assaulted. I was, you know, I'd have like one guy memorably critique my work, and he said, "You're not very good. Do you want to go out?" Just kind of like it was one breath in one sentence. It was like, "You suck. Would you like to go to dinner?" It was like, "No. No, I would, in fact, not like to go to dinner." And it was just all terribly, terribly discouraging and depressing. And I was just hating how I was treated and hating how I couldn't make any inroads. And I was talking to Torn about this, and he showed me this fax he had gotten from his friends at Gainax, Okada and Takeda, and they said, "We want to open a branch in San Francisco, California." And he said, "You know, what about this?" And I'm like, you give me that. Are you talking to anybody else? If you're talking to anybody else, shut up. I want that. That's mine. And as I, you know, say in the comic, you know, I'd push grandmas off the sidewalk for that job. Mm-hmm. And that was in April-ish of 1989. And he, you know, and Torin faxed Okada and Takeda and said, "I have somebody. She's trustworthy and reliable and knows anime and you know, has been in business for herself. You can, you know, she's someone to count on." And they came out to 1989 BayCon and met me, and we, you know, talked a lot over a really huge language barrier. And we occasionally had a translator who is someone named Monty, who eventually became a good friend of mine. Monty, the Mormon missionary, I shit you not. Mm. And so I was pretty much hired before I moved, but, you know, meeting me at BayCon kind of, it was less like sealing the deal and more like sitting down face to face and talking about goals. And, I actually did the first convention where I showed any guy next merchandise or passed out flyers or anything was the June Dallas Fantasy Fair. And then the first time me and the guys from Gainax were all together at a convention was 1989 San Diego Comic-Con. And that's pretty much how it started. I was depressed and destroyed and disappointed by comics. And I thought that this would, you know, fix everything. And I was very, very, very tragically wrong about that.
Yeah, I was going to say, boy, if you think the world of comics is depressing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'll say this, for the year I worked at Gainax, nobody grabbed my ass, and that's an improvement over comics.
God. Ah, jeez. So what exactly did you wind up doing at Gainax, and what were they looking for English speakers to do for them?
I actually spent a lot of time sending faxes and crying.
Okay. Surely that wasn't like the job description.
The majority of my time was just spent waiting for faxes, and when they would finally come, I'd be crushingly disappointed. As a friend of mine named Sean Howell, he came out about December of 89, maybe January of 1990, and started assisting me. You know, one of the many times they said, "No, really, this time you're going to get a shipment of stuff to sell. We swear to God." So when I was working on Banigaru and, you know, writing an outline for the whole thing, I called him and I said, you know, and since, you know, unfortunately, and this kind of still breaks my heart, you know, I couldn't call Torin and say, "Torin, do you recall what my state of mind was like in 1889? Because Torin passed away before I started working on it. So I called Sean and I said, "Do you recall what my state of mind was like in 1989? And he said, "Yeah, you spent time waiting for faxes, and every time you got a fax, you were incredibly disappointed and you cry." And I was like, "Yeah, that sounds about right. I would send faxes, wait for faxes, and cry."
Right.
What they wanted to do was they wanted to basically be They wanted to sell the General Products, and General Products is like the merchandising arm of Gainax, and they had, I think they had two stores, but I know for sure there was the one. It was a very small, cute store. It sold garage kits, which are resin kits that you have to assemble and paint yourself. Mm-hmm. There were merchandise that they got licensed for various shows. They had some of the kits from their own characters, like the Daikon Girl. And they wanted to sell that stuff in the United States. Plus, they wanted to sell other goods, you know, from other shows, many shows and movies. You know, they wanted to sell books, and they wanted to sell the gigas, like pencil boards and phone cards and pencils and just, you know, all the cool stuff you can find at a convention pretty easily now. But that's what they wanted to do. And the thing was, they had this awesome plan, but they didn't actually try to do any of it. They came up with a plan. They said, this is what we're going to do. Here's our catalog. And when I was taking the rough translations of the catalog to translate, there was also a really long list of merchandise that they were going to get with the prices. And then I found out, see, their plan was to go to, there was a chain of stores called Animate, and that was where if you wanted to get, you know, the goodies, the really fun stuff, like the books and pencil boards and plushes and cups and all that stuff, you would go to Animate. That was the place to go.
Right.
And their plan was to go into Animate, buy the merchandise, ship it over here, and sell it at a markup. And when Animate found out the Gainax plan to, you know, buy their stuff, ship it over here, and sell it at a markup, Animate said, we're not selling you anything. Mm-hmm. So a big hunk of the planned business was gone before I ever even moved to California. And it was just kind of like that through the whole year. It's like, hooray, we're going to do this. And then, you know, reality would hit. You know, they kind of didn't, you know, think about feasibility before they said they were going to do something. They would just say, we're going to do this. And then it would be, you know, plan and reality, you know, collided often, and reality usually won. So, but that was the idea, was to sell goods and merchandise and start to bring over books, you know, translated manga. I mean, the kind that would become popular 10 years later, you know, a you know, Tankobon format $10 book, which even in 1989, I said, this is the size and the price point you want, because this is what fans are used to paying for an untranslated Tankobon.
Right.
They like it this size, this many pages, and this price. It's perfect. It's the perfect price point. And we were gonna sell all the things. And that was the point. And another thing, you know, we made a to-do list when we sat down at BayCon in 1989. Was to get Tankobon over. It was to finally produce some good dubbed translations of anime. Because up until that point, they hadn't really been very good at all. And to start bringing over, you know, just good books, just to make really serious inroads and make what kind of a combination of what Viz does now, which is manga and video, plus, you know, a really good anime store was the goal, you know, plus a convention. And, you know, they all kind of little bit happened, but not, you know, not in 1 year and not even in 2.5 years. So, but right. That was the plan.
What was your impression of Gainax at the time? Like, what was working with them like? Did the sort of common, I think, image of them in the late 80s, mid-late 80s, is still this sort of scrappy band of guys just barely scraping by the seat of their pants, kind of a little bit of a Mickey Mouse organization there. Was that your impression of them? Is that how they came across to you? Like, what was your image of them?
No, not at all, in fact. I mean, they worked in a very tiny space, but it was always a hive of activity. People were constantly working, I'm not really sure how early they came in, because I was never in particularly early because I didn't have to be. But, you know, in the main room, there were all the office people, and they were always, you know, officing like crazy. I guess I need to draw a map for people. And you come off the elevator, the main room is all of the people that do admin and drive things, you know, drove the company vehicle to do things. And there was a wall, and on the other side of that wall were the animators. And I don't recall if there were six or eight desks, but the animators worked in there. And then forward and to the left was a room with a table and chairs and a TV and VCR. And they made this room by putting in the table and chairs first and then putting these upright file cabinets to make a wall, to make it kind of a meeting space. And it was so tight that you had to walk across. If you wanted to sit to, you know, if you wanted to get to the far end of this small room they had made, you had to walk across the chairs to sit down. And if you walked past Okada's desk, there was a, you know, a plastic flap curtain kind of thing. And there were guys in there working on the garage kits. And if you walk to the right of Okada's desk, there were guys in there on computers, you know, busting their asses on making the computer games they were making at the time. And if you went to Okada's desk and took a right, you were in the general products shop. I mean, but they crammed all of this into an incredibly tiny amount of square footage, and they were always busy. And you know, even with the disappointment over Animate, it didn't strike me that they were, you know, very Mickey Mouse at all. You know, the experience was incredibly frustrating, but it just kind of, the frustration built up over time, because you sort of look at things like that happening and go, well, you know, those are growing pains, or that was a miscommunication, or, well, these things happen. And but they didn't strike me as I didn't really have any inkling that it was going to go like it did at the beginning, because they were producing films. They were working on Secret of Blue Water at the time. So, I mean, these guys were very, very busy. It wasn't like they were sitting around. And at the time, also, they were still running a convention called Wonder Festival. I guess they eventually sold it.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time, they were also doing that. When I got there just before the Wonderfest convention, which was a two-day convention entirely devoted to garage kits.
Right.
And so, no, they didn't look like slackers, and they aren't slackers. They're just kind of really, really, really disorganized.
That's more what I meant. I don't think anyone's impression was that these guys didn't work hard, but more that it was kind of slapdash. Like, everything was always right on the verge of falling apart, but somehow the car kept moving, you know?
Yeah, and I didn't get that impression either. What I did know going in was that they kept making business deals to make things, and kept making really, really foolish decisions in how to get things financed that ended up causing them a lot of grief and costing them a lot of money.
Right.
You know, we used to often say, it'd be like, wow, Gainax just made another butt-reaming deal to get something made. And they just seem to keep making this mistake over and over again, is that, you know, Wings of Anyamis, when it was translated by a company called Go East, it was kind of butchered. And Okada even talked about sitting in the audience in L.A. and hearing the guy who was somehow involved with the production going, yeah, you know, it really needed to be fixed. It wasn't that good. It's how it was in Japan is not really that important. And Okada made this kind of face and went, ho, ho, ho. But that was it, is that they just kept making these big sacrifices,
mm-hmm.
For a short-term gain to get something made. and it would just cost them so dearly, kind of like people over here who get really hungry to have their work published and take a deal where they have absolutely no rights to their own work.
Oh, like the Rising Stars of Manga.
Like the Rising Stars of Manga, exactly. Like Rising Stars of Manga, like anybody pretty much who did an OEL book for Tokyo Pop. It's like there was this very short-term game, and the long short-term gain and the long game was just, I can make something else. And it's like, yeah, if you're not completely disheartened by the experience, yeah. So that was mainly it. They were bad businessmen. They were hardworking, bad businessmen. That sums it up really well. Just edit out everything I said up to that point. They were very hardworking, very bad businessmen. And what I found out from reading the Notenki memoirs, which was, you know, my boss's, Takeda's memoir, mm-hmm. was all of a sudden, it was kind of like, you know, you have those dramatic stories where someone talks to a relative they've been estranged from, and they tell them things that suddenly make all of the horrible things from their young adult or childhood, all of a sudden you're like, it all makes sense now. Now I understand that relative wasn't an asshole or mentally ill. There were problems. Mm. And reading his memoirs, I was like, oh God, now it all makes so much more sense, because at the time it made no goddamn sense at all. I would, before I left for California, I sent them a fax. I sent them two faxes. I sent them on consecutive days and told them, okay, I am driving to California now. And this is, you know, well before email was common. So we're sending faxes, making phone calls. I sent them a fax, said, okay, I'm now driving to California to, you know, set up Gynax in California. I'm not going to be in touch for 5 days. I'll be on the road. We won't be able to communicate. If you need anything, fax Torn, because Torn was the go-between. And then I sent them that fax again before I left, and then I kept expecting to hear something from them. And every day, you know, full of excitement about what was ahead of me, I would call Torn and say, did you hear from them? And he'd say, I haven't heard a word. And this was the whole trip, and the trip itself was so fucking horrible. It was sort of like I was being warned, and I was like, no, it's going to be great. This trip sucks, but this job is going to be great. No, but this trip is terrible, and the job is going to be great. And when I got there, the only communication I got from them was I was house-sitting for a friend while our apartment was getting ready, and it wasn't going to be ready till mid-September, I think, something like that. And so I'm house-sitting, and I'm opening all the mail that's come in for Gynax, our general products, and just waiting to hear from them. And finally, Torrin says, I've heard from Gynax, and I'm super excited, because this is already after I've, you know, taken my trip to see them in August. I went to Japan for 2 weeks in August. I went to Texas. We packed in a week, and then we were on the road. And I don't hear from them. And then Torrin says, okay, while I'm still asking, he says, okay, they say you need to do the taxes. And I'm like, how, what am I supposed to give them? There was, you know, tax laws, as you know from later stories about Gynax, it's like tax laws are very specific, and tax investigators are like Columbo. They will not stop until they get their person. And so they're very specific tax documents, but there was no understanding of the difference between how things worked in the United States and how things worked in Japan. And so each of us was kind of assuming the other understood that this was how things were done or not done. Mm-hmm. And what we needed besides a translator is we also needed kind of a cultural translator to go, no, that's not how things are done here. You'll have to explain it. And we just totally lack that. That's part of the lack of organization and part of the, you know, we're not very good businessmen thing. And then I sort of muddled through the taxes, which, you know, I gave an accounting of the money I had spent so far and the money that had come in. And then I quit hearing from them again. And then I don't hear from them until I have moved into the apartment, you know, for 2 weeks. And And when I finally do hear from them, it's via torrent. And the thing was, I moved into the apartment, I got the phone set up, and I sent a fax. I sent a fax saying, I'm in the apartment now, what's going on? And I still don't hear anything. And then Torin calls me and says, the guys have faxed me and they want to know why you're not talking to them. It's like, where have you been? They keep trying to fax your number and you don't answer. And I'm like, what number are they trying to fax? And, you know, even after two faxes and phone calls and more faxes, they were still trying to send communications to an apartment in Texas that I hadn't lived in for a month.
Right.
It's like after all that, they didn't get any of the faxes they sent saying, I'm gone for 5 days. I'm here. Fax Torin. Fax this number. I'm here now. Fax me. They just, for some reason, none of that ever got to the right desk. And then they, you know, they finally send a fax saying, she's not talking to us. What's wrong? I don't think it's my fault.
Right.
I'm pretty sure it's not my fault. So it was like that, and it took until I didn't get a shipment of catalogs to even send out to the people who had sent money for them until I believe it was December, like just, you know, first week or two of December of 1989, and I'd been hired the previous May, and the catalogs had been printed. I believe the catalogs had been printed in August, perhaps September. And I was really stoked about this because I got this official paperwork, and I had to go to like four or five different places to just find the dock that the shipment was on. And I was really stoked. I thought the merchandise had finally come in. I could start telling people about it. I could start filling orders. I could not wait to see the treasures that were coming. Let me tell you, I was stoked. And after running around to everybody in the world, I finally find the dock and have the right papers to pick up my shipment. And it is one very modestly sized box. And I thought I was going to shit myself because I was like, this is not my merchandise. This isn't it. What's going on? And it's just a box of catalogs. And in December, after all that waiting, I had a box of catalogs, and I still had nothing to sell. And they also were not paying me on time either.
Of course. So. Yeah, right. Did this ever come together?
Did the company ever cohere, you mean?
Did this ever come together? Were you ever able to actually sell things?
I was. That's the thing, that in the whole year I worked, I finally did get a shipment. And we were, you know, with the help of Sean Howell, who was, you know, working with me, we were finally able to send out a few things. But as far as, you know, selling all the treasures that were in the general products catalog, I think we sold a few of them. But I would have to say that the whole first year was pretty much a wash.
So what happens next? Do you quit? Do you move on? What happens next?
A funny story that really kind of explains how they thought is, you know, I talked about hiring an assistant. It's like, well, if we're ramping up, you know, I'm going to need somebody to help me, you know, stuff envelopes and handle orders and stuff. And they were like, you can have an assistant if he likes to be paid in garage kits. And as it turns out, you know, Sean was looking for a change of venue. He was, you know, kind of tired of San Antonio. He kind of wanted to see what California was like for a while. And Sean would, in fact, take his pay in garage kits. It was like totally straight up. And so, you know, once again, we were in a tiny apartment, and I finally found a house because, again, we're thinking, all right, the treasure truck is about to back up to the house and we're all going to be as rich as kings. And to use Torin's phrase, vacationing on the Riviera, because Torin was always convinced that General Products USA was going to be huge and that he was going to be, you know, struggling along in a 4x4 office attached to the back of the apartment that Torin and his partner Lois Bihalis lived in. I mean, he really thought, you know, the future was bright for General Products USA. anyway, I sent them a fax saying I've hired an assistant, and we moved into a we also moved from this apartment because it turns out the apartment was extremely unsafe, and I was worried about theft. And okay. So we moved to a secure house with plenty of room for the merchandise that was coming any day now. And I said, I've hired an assistant, and I have moved, and I got this fax, and I'm waiting for them. I'm waiting and waiting and waiting. And, you know, and every time that fax goes on, and there's the boops and the beeps and the sounds like an old-fashioned modem, and my heart would start to pound, and I would run to it. And this was one of those times, and on a very strange letterhead that had a picture of camels kind of slumping across the desert, and it said at the top, I Will Not Complain, Incorporated, and it was a very angry fax saying, we didn't tell you you could hire an assistant, and why have you moved to a house, and what were you thinking of anyway? And I'd been sending faxes all along saying, I found an assistant who will work for Garage Kits, and we have to move to a house because there's not enough room here, and this place isn't secure, and I don't want us to get robbed. Mm-hmm. And they missed all of those faxes, too. So what happens at the end of the year is I think my breaking point was this, is that one of the things Gainax had in the catalog was this Godzilla hand puppet, which is this really neat rubber Godzilla hand puppet, just like it says on the box. And when I went to WonderCon that year, it was still being held in Oakland, and there was this other guy who ran a store of garage kits, and there was a really fairly large one, and there was a small one, and I'm talking about the larger one. And mainly the merchandise he sold were, pirated kits that had been bought in Japan and then, you know, recast and pirated in China. And a lot of his merchandise was pirated. Mm-hmm. So, you know, here's a guy who's not a particularly good citizen anyway, and he's exhibiting at WonderCon, and I have still not gotten any appreciable amount of merchandise to sell. I haven't even gotten stuff that Gainax makes, like the Godzilla hand puppet. And I go by his table at WonderCon, and he has Godzilla hand puppets. Right. And that's the point where I snapped. And I remember walking up to Torin, and I was so mad, I could not unclench my teeth. And I'm kind of like, oh, my teeth going, God damn it. He has a hand puppet. He has our merchandise, and I don't even have our merchandise. I work for this company, and even I don't have our own merchandise, and somehow this guy got it. Mm-hmm. And I look like a big idiot because I'm the one who's supposed to be running the pro company here.
Yeah.
And that was kind of, I think that was really kind of where I snapped. And I was already really depressed. And I tend to be kind of a depressed person anyway. But I had so little work to do. I mean, I would get paid about every 2.5 months, and I was supposed to get money monthly, not just my salary, but money to just, you know, pay the rent and keep the lights on. And I, in Bandigato, I think I said I got paid 7 times in 12 months, and I don't even think it was that many times. Because every month was, you know, a multitude of faxes that went from matter of fact to wheedling to angry saying, where's my money? Because I was like, and I wasn't getting paid, and I couldn't pay my own bills, you know? And what was it in, let me think here. So in January, I had absolutely nothing to do, and I was kind of just sitting on my own thumb, and I was, you know, not only Gainax was depressing me, but I'd been trying to do comics, and I made this really weird thinking happen that I'm not sure why, but it was kind of like, well, if I work on Gainax, I'm going to devote myself to that, and I'm just going to leave comics behind. And I kind of realized over that year, okay, I can't do that. I'm not constitutionally able to quit drawing. And not drawing and painting and not making comics was depressing me even more than things going, you know, very poorly with Gainax. And so I had so little to do. I was actually able to go back to school and take 2 illustration classes and still keep up with what I had to do for Gainax because there was nothing to do. I actually went back to school part-time. Okay. Took a semester of school because I had nothing to do. But in, kind of like a year about the point where I had, you know, from when I had taken the job, I had a nervous breakdown. I just came to that point where I realized it wasn't going to work. And this big dream of working for Gainax and being a huge success and showing them all was not going to happen. This was just never, ever going to happen. And it just broke my heart. It was terrible. And and I realized by the end of the second day, I cried for like 48 hours straight. You know, I cried when I was eating. I cried when I was walking. You know, I'd cry myself to sleep. I'd cry in the shower to save time. And after 48 hours of crying, I realized I had to quit.
Right.
Because I was just coming unglued. And I handed it to Sean and just tried not to look back.
Right.
And I'm very surprised to... Excuse me.
That's okay.
And I'm sitting here being very surprised that 25 years later, that still makes me cry.
Well, that's understandable.
I was just so disappointed, and I'd sort of, pinned everything on this.
Right.
You know, my life, my career, status, you know, like social status, and it felt so bad knowing that it could have been so good because I knew what I was doing and I was ready and I was hardworking and I was clever and I was enthusiastic and you just, some shit just doesn't fly and it's not your fault. But it was just awful and it was so hard to walk away from that and feel like I had lost a whole year of my life. You know?
Yeah, but on the other side of it, I would say that, I mean, you know, just to throw this out there, you even being anywhere near that as a thing, as a company that went on to become legendary, them even attempting that and you being part of it and you having been a part of Torrance Smith's life, I mean, you were a part of history.
Yeah.
You know, you're part of history.
Yes.
So, like,
I mean, that was...
You know.
That was the upside. I mean, thinking about how it all finished hurts, but, you know, which is not to say there was no upside. We're just kind of talking about the train wrecky parts of it.
Sure.
But, you know, on the upside, I very much wanted to live in California, so mm-hmm. I was there. I got to see, you know, what I was there for. It didn't happen, but, you know, I got to... You know, I got to work with Torin, was really not the easiest person at all times, but, you know, I got to be a part of, you know, I think objectively, not just subjectively, but objectively, the best packager of manga that's ever been in the... in the United States. There are others that are, there are ones that are better than others, but, you know, he was the one who really made the inroads and really cared what it looked like. And so I got to spend time with him. And so, you know, I'm not saying it was all bad, but, you know, that year was difficult, and you kind of get an idea of how difficult it was that it's, you know, it's taken me 25 years to feel like I'm ready to talk about it because, you know, I've tried writing about it before. I didn't give an interview about it for 10 years because I didn't know what I could say about it that didn't sound bad. So right. It was just hard to talk about. But there were things about the year that, you know, as far as running Darn Products goes, that was a total wash. On the other hand, You know, I got to go to Japan twice, and these guys are inarguably terrible businessmen, but they were a lot of fun to be with. You know, Takeda is a really fun guy. He was great fun to be with, and Mr. Kanda, who was kind of the guy in charge of General Products USA, is I think the best word for him is merry. He was a very merry fellow. Mm-hmm. Okada was funny. Ono was very nice, but, you know, he was, I didn't see him much. And I think the first time I saw him, he had actually just been asleep under his desk because he had been, you know, he was working on Nadia and he had just, you know, gone to sleep under his desk, which wasn't unusual. And everybody that worked at Gainax was really, really nice. They were all very, very nice people. And I got to go and meet Kenichi Sonoda and see him in his studio. And when I returned to Japan in January, I got to... and there's a guy, and I am completely blanking on his name, but when they told me about him, they said, oh, you'll like him. He has his hair funny colors, and he drives a motorcycle, and he's totally cool. And then this guy shows up one day, and he is... He really kind of stood out amongst these people because these guys are all very, you know, shirt sleeve guys, polo shirts and t-shirts and shirt sleeves. They're really casual dressers. And this dude shows up and he is so clean and so sharp and so polished looking and really, really good looking. And I'm like, who is that guy? Mm-hmm. Because, which is not to say the guys at Gainax were, you know, dirty or anything. It's just that they look very casual and he really stood out because he was just, he just looked well off. And they're like, oh, I think his name was Machi. And they're like, oh, that's Machi. And I'm like, that's Machi? This is the guy who's supposed to have the funny colored hair and drives a motorcycle. And it's like Machi got a makeover. And he didn't look anything like they had told me. Yeah, this was a guy who was supposed to be kind of punk and kind of rebellious looking. And instead, here's a guy who's just like really smooth and polished. You know, just like, and really attractive. And I'm like, oh my God, who is that guy? And I went out with, I'm pretty sure his name was Machi. And I went out with Machi and Takeda. And we went out, you know, we had beers and it was like pink beer. That's a thing. And then we went out to this club called Trap Space Ava, AVA. And so we went out and danced, and we went and ate at a Burger King really late, and it was very dry. And I got to, you know, spend a – I'm actually going to cover this in Banigaru, you know, call it my dream date with Takeda, because we spent a day doing things like going to Harajuku and eating ice cream and eating more ice cream. And it was really sweet and kind of awkward and it was really cool. So it's not all bad stuff. A lot of really cool things happen. It's just that nothing connected with actually trying to run General Products was particularly cool, but the two trips I got to take were great. The two trips were terrific. And I would love it if you could go to a Japanese bath here, United States, because those are great.
Before, so you went on to do a few other things. You worked on some manga for quite a while.
Yeah.
You did.
Yep.
It sounds like you did lettering and some writing.
Lettering and writing. I actually. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, I wrote for Torin for, oh gosh, I think it was 3 years, and I didn't even think about it. I just wrote it and turned it in, and then kind of forgot about it because, you know, I had two kids and were in grade school and, you know, both of them with learning disabilities, and I would just kind of turn in work and collect checks and not think about it. And I look back on it, it was like, holy shit, I was turning out a lot of work. But when I was writing for Torin, I was rewriting 3x3 Ice, What's Michael, and Oh My Goddess, and some of the adult books as well, and also lettering. So I was actually for a while there doing quite a lot, and then the, you know, the bottom fell out of everything, so
right, exactly,
there you go.
And I saw listed in your credits you worked on the Marvel Mangaverse.
Oh, you not only saw that listed in my credits, people asked about that on Twitter. Yes, I heard about that when everything but the Punisher book had been assigned. When I was living in San Antonio, you know, I was very close to where Antarctic Press's office was, and I think I heard about it from somebody who was usually there, or I went in one day and I saw that and I was like, damn it, I should be doing one of these books. I'm perfect.
Right.
So I found out who was editing it, and I called him, which is pretty much, I mean, kids, if you're looking for advice on how to get work, that's pretty much what you do. If you find out somebody is doing something you want to work on, you find out the name of the editor, and you email them or you call them, and you ask if they have a spot for you. That's how you get work. So I emailed or called the editor, I don't recall which, and said, I'm perfect for this. Here are my bona fides. And right then I was actually still working, doing a series for Image and doing a series with Oni. So, yeah, I looked pretty good at that point. And so, yeah, we did the one issue of the Marvel Mangaverse Punisher, and Peter David was the writer. And it was a lot of fun. Actually, I turned in my last panel on 11 o'clock on December 24th, and then I actually put my two grade school kids in a car and tried to drive to a place an hour north of Dallas called Lowry Crossing. And it was like, this is the life of a freelancer. You turn things in at 11 o'clock on Christmas Eve, and then you take a road trip because you're a dumbass.
Right.
But what do you want to know about that? I liked it. I had a lot of fun doing it.
I would do it again.
It's
just interesting to hear a little bit about it. That whole time, looking especially at something like Marvel Mangaverse, most people look back on it now and think like, wow, this was really hilariously misguided, and not, you know, people laugh at it now, frankly. But I think at the time, you know, they were just, I don't know. What was your opinion on, like, what they were trying to do?
I mainly what I cared about it is if there was a Mangaverse version of something, I wanted to draw it, because that's where, to paraphrase Nelson, drawing manga style, that's where I'm a Viking. Was it Nelson or the other kid on The Simpsons? I don't remember. Anyway, I was like, well, if they're doing that, that's, you know, one of my few opportunities to work for Marvel or DC, because, you know, I mean, I had submitted stuff before and talked to people before, and pretty much the answer, you know, when you're drawing in a more manga influenced style, at least at the time, was, you know, kind of, well, we've already got our person that draws manga style. You know, pretty much, you know, if a company had their manga artist, then they had their manga style artist, and it was kind of like Highlander, there could be only one.
Mm-hmm.
And so this seemed a perfect opportunity for me to get some work with some visibility, and it would also pay pretty well. And so it was kind of a combination of, I want visible work, I want a little respect. And it was a pretty fat paycheck. I mean, not as good as some people, but it was, at the time, for, you know, 22 pages, it was a lot of money for 22 pages of work and a cover, and I needed it, and I wanted to do it. So I had fun. I mean, I think since The Punisher, for people who don't know, The Punisher, it's set in Japan, and rather than being Frank Castle, it is a woman who is a private school principal, and in her guise as the Punisher, she pretty much doles out fetish punishments to bad guys to get what she wants out of them. And it was kind of weird and kind of kinky, but not exactly. And when I got the script, I was emailing back and forth with Peter David, and in the first few pages, it calls for drawing this bad guy being hogtied and having his feet spanked or something. No, actually having his butt spanked. That's what it was. And so I think it was, I wrote to Peter and said, do you have any hog tying reference? And he's just like, would you please just look it up yourself? And he's like, maybe, I don't know, maybe it was once it was written, he was just like, don't ask me these questions. But, you know, so I had to look up hog tying reference to draw a Marvel comic.
Well, there you go.
And I actually really enjoyed doing the research and designing the costumes and everything. I had just a huge amount of fun with it. I have no regrets.
All right, then.
And this is the thing, you know, people can think it's misguided or not, but my paycheck cashed real nice.
Well, there you go. Hey, you know, you're a working artist. What do you want? All right. So before we let you go here, we got a few questions from Twitter for you. A lot of people really just sort of wanted you to contrast, like, if you still follow Gainax, and if you still watch their work, and, you know, do you keep up with that stuff? Do you still watch their output and sort of compare it to, you know, what they're doing back when you were working with them?
Oh yeah. I couldn't, for a while, I couldn't follow them, but that was mainly because, you know, money and two little kids. But, you know, I really loved Ava, and it was actually not too difficult to get because I believe I was actually renting it from a local video store, I think. So I followed Ava, and I never saw it to the end originally because a friend of mine, you know, my daughter was watching it, and she was really enchanted by this, and she's like three, and he said, okay, it gets kind of harsh later, and so at that point I was like, hey, look, a Goofy movie.
Right.
But gosh, when Ava first started, I was like, man, I love the heck out of this. It's like, and there was just kind of, you know, when I think about it, it was like there was real no bitterness in me about how things went. I still loved what they did. I just, you know, I wish that the whole general products thing had worked out. But maybe if it had, I would have quit drawing comics. And I don't know if anybody feels like that would have been a tragic loss for American comics, but it certainly, I don't think I would have been nearly as happy in a way if it had been a success, because I would have probably quit drawing, which would have been too damn bad. God, I loved Ava because it was a really, to me at least, it was a really fresh take on giant robots. Ava for giant robots was, for me, what The Incredibles was for superhero movies. I thought I didn't like superhero movies, but what I didn't like was bad ones. And I saw The Incredibles, and I was like, my God, I do like superheroes. I just like good ones. And for Ava, it was like, yeah, I'm kind of indifferent to robot shows, but then here's Ava, and then I'm like, I fucking love robots. I do. I love good robots. And which is not to say Ava didn't kind of like go flying off the rails eventually. But it was so fresh. I really loved it. I really enjoyed Panty and Stocking with Garter Belt.
Mm-hmm.
That just has the wrong baked right into it. And it is really crude and horrible. And, you know, people ask me, well, how do you reconcile liking Panty and Stocking with Garter Belt with your problems with, you know, Gunbuster 2? And it's like, well, in Panty and Stocking with Garter Belt, it's supposed to be gross.
Mm-hmm.
It's not trying to pretend to be anything else, whereas, you know, you watch Gunbuster 2, and it's got beautiful character design and gorgeous animation and some incredibly heart-wrenching moments. It just freaking kill you. You know, just stories about people who are getting too old to, you know, aging out of, you know, flying Buster machines. And once you can't fly one anymore, there's no going back. And it's just watching characters age out of being able to do it is just, it's really genuine emotion. It really got to me. But at the same time, it seemed like, you know, the main character couldn't appear on the screen for longer than 1 second without a shot of her crotch or her butt or her boobs. And it was so, so fucking exasperating. I'm like, why are you doing this? You're making your main character just this kind of toy. And she's really powerful and important. And it seems like you can't have this powerful and important, incredibly important and powerful, and and driven character who just wants to be someone without also just turning her into this object and kind of making fun of her. It's like there was this, almost this hostility. Like, we really hate this character because she's so good. We're going to make her look as stupid as possible. And it wasn't even like there was equal time where all the characters were exploited that way or all the girls were exploited that way or like in Kill la Kill where everybody is exploited visually in a really extreme sexual way. So I love the way it looked, but I had a really deep problems with how kind of fan service-y and gross it was. But, you know, but they've had better things and they've had worse things. But in general, the thing about Gainax from the very beginning is these guys just, even when it fails so big.
Right.
You know, when it succeeds, it's kind of mind-blowing and gorgeous. And as my soon-to-be husband is fond of saying, if you're going to go down in flames, hit something big.
Right.
And that's what they do. When they go down in flames, they really go big. I kind of love that about them. And when it's successful, it's Ava. And, you know, Ava has kind of become like the Star Trek in Japan, where there are just these endless iterations of it, where they can just keep going back. It's like, well, you know, things are looking a little lean. Let's do another Ava thing. You know, I'm impressed. I really liked Ava from the very beginning, but I'm impressed at how much mileage they have gotten out of a story about the end of the world. Mm-hmm. You know, it's always going to be the same conclusion. It's not like Trek where it's your never-ending quest for things. It's here's the end of the world with giant robots. That's pretty much how it's always going to end up. It has a very finite point to it, and yet they managed to keep, you know, endlessly reiterating this. And I kind of like, I'm not sure I care for that much from a storytelling point of view or some kind of weird purity point of view, but for a business point of view, I really admire it in a way.
Right.
So yes, I have kept up to some degree. I have to say, I've never seen Otaku no Video, and I saw a little bit, and I kind of was not real pleased with how, you know, myself, Sean Howell, and Sean's assistant, Craig York, were portrayed. I thought it was, everybody kind of got gored. Everybody was made fun of, but it was just, it was a little too close to the bone.
Right.
And I didn't find it funny because they were kind of, you know, mocking our sincerity. And I was like, you know, I quit making comics and I moved and I risked a relationship and I sacrificed a lot to see this happen because I really believed in this and I really wanted anime and manga to be a thing for everyone over here. I was really passionate about that, and it stung and made me angry to see my sincerity mocked. So I have never actually watched you talk into a video beyond that. Once I saw that, I was like, I'm done with this guy. I don't even want to see this because that's not how it was, and it wasn't funny to me. But the rest of it, hey, they're terrific. They're goons, but they're terrific goons.
Okay. And finally, we got a question here from at Bunny Cartoon, who just wants to know what it was like as a woman back in the late 80s. I would expand that to, you know, both comics and working at Gainax, and how it is now, if you contrast those two.
I never had a single problem at Gainax that had, as far as I know, if there was a problem, it was like, it was completely over my head. They were always gentlemen, and I was just another person in the office. There were a few awkward moments, but it had more to do with a cultural divide And also with the fact that, you know, Takeda's my boss. I'm, you know, young and slim and attractive. And, you know, and I'm the American in this office. And Takeda's fiance was not real crazy about that. She wasn't ugly about it, but she wasn't real crazy about it. But that was just a kind of people thing. But they were, you know, very gentlemanly and very nice. And so there was nothing weird there. I mean, I kind of cover some of the awkwardness in my Dreamgate with Takeda, because there were points where things were awkward. But they were great. Now, as far as comics in the late 80s, I covered that earlier on. It was an interesting time to be in comics, but comics was in one of its states of bust. You know, it's like another speculation, comic speculation bubble had burst. And so, you know, business-wise, it was difficult, but just pretty much from the point of view of being a female and how it was okay for, and the ways it was okay for men to act and how you just had to nudged up and deal with it, or, you know, not make a scene about it, or, you know, let it go kind of stuff. I mean, I've been hearing that shit my whole career, and it was a problem. I mean, that's part of the reason I thought working for Gainax was going to solve all my problems, is I could leave all that bullshit, all the sexist bullshit, and, you know, and the market shrinking bullshit behind.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I think that about wraps us up. Really can't thank you enough for coming on and sharing those stories with us.
It was my pleasure. I'm really flattered to be asked, actually. You guys are terrific.
Well, I thank you very much. That's a humbling thing to say. It's just, it's such sure. A unique time for you to have specifically been a part of. And I also want to just make sure people check that comic out, because it's really great. It's funny and really well drawn, and it's really well put together. So everyone should absolutely check that out.
I want to give big props to Rob Bishes at Boing Boing. He is the editor at Boing Boing, who actually, I mean, I've been pitching that for 7 years, and you know, he was the first one who realized that it was really great. I mean, I had other people who were like, nobody wants to read about the anime and manga business. And I was like, wow, okay, you're not the agent for me, clearly. But Rob was the person who took it on board at Boing Boing, and I can't thank him enough.
Fantastic. So everybody check that out. And once again, thanks for coming on.
Okay, that's our show. Big thanks to Leah for showing up. The theme song is Bucharest. It's by the band The New Division. You can check them out at newdivisionmusic.com. Don't forget, subscribe to us on iTunes. Leave us a little rating or review. We'd really appreciate it. And we will see you all next week.